Accession number 27097, Reel 3.
You've got to start.
We used to get Swede soup 300 days out of 365, really. And, you know, when it won in season, it was dehydrated, you know, shredded, dried Swede.
You must have all been suffering from various things, from lack of vitamins.
Yeah, we used to get fed from dustbins. We used to get about a half a pint Cocotin. We never had cups or anything like that. It was just what you got out of a Red Cross parcel, you know, a tin to feed out of. And it was round about a Cocotin of soup, which sometimes was just water. I used to get, in the morning, you used to get ersatz coffee. I don't know what it was made of, acorns or something. And you used to get a cup of that. And at 11 o'clock, you used to get the rations dished out, which was a seventh of a loaf of bread. One day you would have sweet jam and your bread, and the next day you would have ersatz margarine. The next day, a cube. And that was your daily diet. Unless some rubbish came back from the Russian front, which they used to call stink cheese, which was a little cube. You could have that, but people couldn't stomach it. They couldn't eat it. So that was the daily diet. So when the Canadian parcel came, as I told you, there was coffee and tea and different things in it. Was of no use because we had no fires, and the barrack rooms all the time was mostly either full of water in the puddles, the pits in it, due to the snow, which we used to get from, snow used to be from early November until about April.
Long
and
winded.
Used to come off the chap's boots, you know, in the doings there.
What was your sleeping accommodation like?
The sleeping accommodation was bunks, which was absolutely infested. Three tier. These bed bugs was there, you know. I mean, whether you got immune to them or no, but I mean, you had them in nearly all the wood. Anyway, as I was saying, this pile of wood was in block 7, and the chaps were, you know, gone to lunch because they were privileged. And Doug Palfrey and Robert Gray and myself decided that we would like some hot coffee and we'd like some hot tea. And the only possible way to get it was to raid the wood pile right under the machine gun tower. And it was up a drive, about side entrance of about 50, 60 yards. Anyway, we marched up there and pretended to measure up the wood of these planks and picked out three. And Bob walked on the side, and Doug and myself put the planks on my shoulder and his shoulder and walked away with the German looking out over the top, not saying a word. Every step I took down this 50, 60 yards to the main road, main avenue up the camp, I could feel the machine gun bullet coming. I could, you know, every step I took, I thought, so he's going to twig on, you know. Gets down to the main avenue, walked up the avenue, and we had a notorious little German there. He was only about 5'2", but he was a real gunslinger. He'd shoot anyone. So, going up with the wood on our backs, and Bob walking beside of us, when he came up to the German, which they used to like all the pomp and ceremony, he gave an eyes left and threw up a salute to him, see, and oh, the Jerry thought that was great, and he saluted back, this little bloke. And we walked about, must have been about 20, 30 yard. And the next thing we heard was, "Alt! Alt!" And we went faster. And he said, "All for Fluchtemar," he said. And he pulled out his revolver and shot at us up the avenue. And we ran with the planks on our back. Now, probably you won't believe this. We ran right opposite our compound. And we dropped them in the road. And it was two cords of wire with a coil in the middle. And we slung them over the top into our compound. And ran like the dickens, because he was gaining on us, in round to our compound. Got into our compound, and you know, you probably won't believe this, we never seen that wood all the time that we were left in that camp. It just disappeared like that. So the next thing was that all the sirens blew in the camp, and they locked all the compounds up. And the Gestapo came to search the compounds where this wood had gone. Anyway, they came into the compound that it was in, you know. And the compounds, as I say, were divided with coils down, and they came in the right compound. They searched, and the German walked up and through the file and had a look at us to see if he could recognise any of us. And he didn't recognise one of us. They didn't stop there. They searched the next compound because he thought he made a mistake. And they never found it. And we never found it. It just disappeared. Absolutely. And you probably wouldn't believe that. But
I believe it. Yeah.
They...
Because there's always in the things on television about prisoner of war camps, it's always very chummy and cosy, isn't it? And
yeah, it obviously went
on very well.
It obviously went down to a tunnel, I should think. I should think probably the compound before had a tunnel and it went down quickly out the way. And but we never seen it. We never had our hot coffee or our hot tea.
Because was it... Was it everyone for himself, really?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'll tell you more about that later. Mm. Anyway, that was one little do we had in the camp.
What heating did you have in the winter? Did you not have a stove or anything in your...
No stove, no, no. Then time dragged on. It was about 1944... or 1943, late 43, they started the first repatriation. And I've been in a sick compound still, was hopeful that I might be repatriated. Anyway, my friend Doug from Bristol, he was on the repatriation. So we knew that soon as ever they cleared out all that they thought, you know, was due for repatriation, that we would be then put down as the working compound, which I wasn't fit to work, but I never intended working. And anyway, repatriation came up, and his name came up for repatriation. So we sat on the bunk one night and we thought, any officer or junior officer or NCO was not compelled to work for him, not compelled to work for the German. They had the option. They could work or they could not. So we fathomed it out one night on the bunk there that he should send a verification from England to say that we were NCOs, Bob Gray and myself, you see. So exactly the thing happened that we thought. He came on repatriation. We were put down into the working compound. Gets down in the working compound, and about we were there about 2 or 3 weeks, and Bob's verification from England came out, and we had a quick look at it, and it was put to whom it may concern. It is to certify that Robert Gray was made corporal in the field such and such a day on Crete, you see. Anyway, he took it to the officer that was in charge of our compound, and the officer took it to the camp commandant. The camp commandant had a look at it and said, put him in the NCO compound. So we were parted. He went to the NCO compound. About a week later, mine arrived. And I did the same thing. I took it to the officer in charge of our compound, and he had a look at it, and he took it to the camp commandant, and the camp commandant said, oh, two of these, never seen any of these within a week. So they locked me up. They took me out, and they locked me up in the cooler. And they interrogated me. They said, oh, when were you made NCO? But I'd already seen the letter. I'd seen what the date was on it. So I kept repeating that all the time, and they kept me there. They kept me in there for 3 days. And I wondered what was going to go on, you see. Anyway, the old camp was shut up. They wouldn't let anybody out of any compound at all. And unknowing to me, they called in all the typewriters that was attached to each compound and tested them and found out the one compared with it, and it genuinely must have come from England. So on the third day they let me out into the NCO compound. Now I walked up the avenue with one German guard and put me in the NCO compound. And later on, when the war was over and I was to work in the post office, there was a chap from the Grenadier Guards and one from, I don't know, the Dorsets, I think, was working in the post office at the same time. And, of course, general doings, you know, where were you and this and that and the other. And they could remember it. The camp was shut up. And this Jerry trolls, you know, the doings to put me in the NCO compound. Anyway, that was it.
You caused them quite a lot of trouble, really.
Yeah. Then, of course, I was an NCO. But then the problem was I kept writing home every... They gave you a card every month that you could write home. And I was writing, you know, when I was putting corporal down on it, you see. People were getting confused. This time, my wife, this is my first wife, was getting confused. You know, she was saying, oh, he's a bad corporal now, you know. How come kind of is this? Anyway, that finished up to the end of the war. But later, after the repatriation, there was a chap came in the camp from the Marines called Thorne. And at the end of this block 7, where the workers used to be, there used to be the main gates, one of the main gates of the camp. And at the far end, about 700-800 yards, there was a general cookhouse. You know. Anyway, we were so hungry that in this space between the 700 and 800 yards, there was a field either side with the avenue up between it, and either side they grew tomatoes. So Taffy, said to me, he said, here, he said, I'm starving. He said, come on, I'd like some of those tomatoes out there. And he said, how do you think we could get any? Well, it was outside the camp, you know, outside the camp, but within the perimeter of the old issue, you see. So he said, we'll get some. So Bob Gray, when he walked up to the gate, and him and I walked up with a dustbin, and you carry the dustbins like you do a jib, you know, with a chap either side, you see. And inside we had a couple of cut bags chucked in. And these tomatoes, the road was running like this, and the tomatoes were planted in rows, adjoining the road. Anyway, we got up there and we managed to get round where they used to throw some old Red Cross tins that were like an old shed place. We got round there and we managed to dive in these tomato rows. And we're gradually working up on our arms up through, crawling. And I heard the sound of jackboots. I heard three German officers. And they were marching along, talking to each other down this road, and I was within nearly me to you, or from Enid to you, from them, lie down on the floor, nicking these tomatoes, and they never seen us. My heart was going like this. So that was enough. So dragged the bag back. We had quite a good few tomatoes. I didn't know where my mate was. He was a row or two down. And we managed to get back, and we saw the chap from the machine gun tower on the corner watching these officers. We managed to get out and put them in the dustbin, put the lid on. We meantime told the chap on the gate, which we got through, that we were sent by the Oberleutnant to fetch some soup for some late prisoners that had come in. That's why he let us out the gate. When we got back, everything went wrong. The guard had changed. Got back near the gate, the Germans wouldn't let us in. There we was, stuck outside with a dustbin, half full of tomatoes, stolen, which we were being shot for. And my mate inside the gate, trying to tell the chap on the gate that we would be wanted for roll call, and he wouldn't let us in. So we didn't know what to do. So Taffy could speak German quite well. And he said, if you won't let us in, he said, we'll go down the main gate and go in. We walked down the main gate, which was about 400 or 500 yards. Down to the main gate, and luck would have it, there was a working party, came back from work and was going in, and we went in with them, and nothing was said, and we had our tomatoes, green ones, we lied on them, we had them for about a month or so. Anyway, we get back in the camp, and that was about the general thing that went on there. Anyway, it came round then to January, and we could hear the Russian guns on one side of the River Oder.
What had been said to you by the German guards and so on? Had they talked about the Russian front?
No. They were very secretive about all that.
What sort of people were they? Were they older, some of the guards?
Some was quite young. Mm. I mean, several things happened in the camp that you wouldn't believe. I mean, I was just going to tell you before my story. The chap that came home from Clutton, his girlfriend used to send him cigarettes, Ardagh cigarettes. And when he came home on repatriation, he said, I'll make the cigarettes over to me in my name, so that when they arrived in the camp, they were mine, you see. Now, for some particular reason, The Germans didn't used to like these Ardaf cigarettes. They'd go for players or woodbines or anything like that and steal them. But these Ardaf would come through regular. And his girlfriend from up near Clutton was sending them to Doug, you see, and they were already in the stream and he kept it up. Anyway, I stored a lot of these cigarettes in my pack. And I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for them. They really saved my life. Anyway, things were dull in the camp and we had, you know, different chaps there that had been in the camp regularly. Anyway, there was a chap there called Bidoff. He was from the Gloucester Regiment. And he was desperate for a cigarette. And nobody would give anything away. You wouldn't give anything away. Even if you had 500, you wouldn't give them away. So one day, across the road from us, there was like a pool, which was for fire, I think, hydrant, you know, and it was always frozen over, you know. So we dared Bidoff to go and jump in this pool and swim across for one cigarette, you know. And all the lads joined together, you know, get that around there. I can see it now. And he stripped, he had nothing on. Go across the road to get in this pool where there's ice on the top to get across. And he was from the Gloucester Regiment. I very often wanted to find out what happened to him, but never have. So Bidoff went across. We cracked the ice on the side. Bidoff to jump in and get across the other side, which wasn't very far, only about the length of this kitchen. He jumped in, and you never believe it, within about 10 seconds, up come a German out the water. Everybody pulled Bidoff out and scrambled and ran back into the barracks, see? The next thing was, there was a group of Germans up there pulling this guy out. And apparently he committed suicide, jumped in the thing, you see. So anyway,
when he came up, he was just a body.
Yeah. Bidoff never got his cigarette. Not even for jumping in the water.
And had the shock of his life, yeah. Actually.
Anyway, I had these cigarettes. I don't know how many it was. I had it in the pack. The 20th of January came, and we could hear the Russian guns, and there was a lot of activity in the camp, and there were 6,000 of us in there, roughly. Anyway, 3,000 they put in cattle trucks and sent off. And the rest, 3,000, we had to walk. And I walked from January the 20th till April the 12th.
So what were you told? You saw the others go off in the cattle trucks?
We knew that they were taking us away from the Russians, you see. We could hear the Russian guns and that, you see. And the Russians were right on our tail all the time, really. So I suppose Hitler was determined that he wasn't going to get, you know, any more, you know, than he should do. Like, he still thought he could win the war.
Yeah. How did that march start off? What sort of mood were you all in?
Well, the other thing was, you see, I mean, you probably won't believe, but, I mean, there was snow on the ground and it was frozen. And I would say it was a foot or so deep. You see, so we had to carry any blanket we had or anything we had, you know. We didn't know what we were going to land up doing at night, you see. And they gave us a Red Cross parcel each when we left the camp. And the majority of people, you see, the bedboards that they were lying on, which was no more than about 8 or 9, they wouldn't issue any more than that. Nailed or strung them together and made like a sledge. So Bob Gray and myself, we done the sledge and we put our stuff on it, you see. But he'd already been shot through the knee and was hobbled quite a bit. We left the camp on the 20th and the snow...
20th of?
January. And the snow in that was, I say... foot or so deep, and there was 3,000 roughly of us went. And the first night, they put us in a, stopped us to a communal farm. Now, you probably won't believe, but I mean, if you were in the front of the column, you got in the barn. If you were in the back of the column, which we were, you were out in the yard. And they used to put a machine gun up round us. And we used to lie in the yard. The first night in the yard, there, you know, we pulled some wheat sheaves down and that to lie on and put the three blankets, I think we had, we put over the both of us, you know. And the tin of Red Cross, packet of Red Cross tin in between us. In the morning, it snowed during the night. In the morning, the first blanket gone. It was absolutely soaked. And went to open a tin of peas, you know. And the tin was frozen inside. It was frozen like it came out of a, like it came out of an ice box. And my friend, he woke up and he could hardly look out of his eyes, and almost frostbite, you know. So that was our first night. Then we moved on, and we got down to Dresden, and there was literally thousands of people on the road, civilians with carts or ponies, a never-ending stream. You couldn't see from one end to the other. And we were getting no food or very little food. And if you walked along a field where there's sugar beet and you tried to nick a sugar beet from the side of it, the Germans used to shoot at you. We used to eat sugar beet with dirt all over it and everything, you know, to try and keep alive. Anyway, that went on. We got outside of Dresden, and then there was a tremendous raid, which was the raid on Dresden.
You saw that?
It was on all night, and the aircraft was flying over us. We were about 5 miles outside. Then we got on to there, then we got on to where the Germans used to make their camera in Seisser Zella, then up to Leipzig.
You must have been getting quite weak by now, were you?
Oh, yeah. Then we got the most notorious place ever I've been in all my life. They stopped us. They didn't know which way to take us come the end. And we diminished so much that there was chaps dying every day, and there's chaps either being sick or absconded or whatever. And we got to this brick factory, and it was three-tier building with thousands of piles of bricks outside, you know, at different doings. And they locked us in there. Well, the only thing was, when you locked in there, there was no solid floor. It was lathes. And if a chap wanted to go to the toilet, whichever way, if you were under, you got it. If you were down the bottom, you got it. Because they locked the place, you couldn't get out. You couldn't avoid it. And you were so tightly packed, you know, that you couldn't get it. You couldn't get anywhere.
I'll stop you there. Maurice Grattan, end of reel 3.